Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast, where you'll learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secure retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast. I'm Big Mike, Mike Zlatnik. Today it is my pleasure and privilege to welcome nobody. We're doing a presentation on a very exciting subject of how to compute risk-adjusted return. Let me start sharing a presentation. And this is, again, very important topic. And as much as you might find it extremely boring, or maybe you'll enjoy the presentation. I hope you actually enjoy it. So we're talking about risk-adjusted return and how market conditions impact risk and reserves needed for each project. So let me keep rolling. This is for educational purposes only. This is not an attempt to sell securities or anything else. And you can read the disclosure if you're interested in one of our funds. Please request a private placement memorandum and consult your financial advisor and a licensed attorney before making any decisions. A couple of words about me, Big Mike. Those of you who have been following the podcast, this is a repetition. You've heard the story before, but you will see an addition here. I'm married with four kids and a cat, and you can see the picture of my cat. And she's a member of the family, so now I have five kids. I've been a fund manager since 2009. I did have a career in the software development for many years and been real estate investor since 2000. I do have a book out, working on the next book, and I manage a couple of funds at this point. The funds are growing at a good rate, and very pleased with that. And we do have focus on short-term bridge hard money loans and long-term equity value-add investing, focused on predictable cash flow, value-add-driven appreciation, self-storage, multifamily, retail, office, and a number of other projects. I'm at your service. You could find me at tampafunding.com. You can also find me at bigmikefund.com. And if you misspell it and you go to the bigmikefund.com, it is not a kinky site, I promise. It'll just URL forward you to the bigmikefund.com. If you would like to get a BPM, go on a website, secured@tampafunding.com, create an account, and you can download prospectus from there, or just email me and I'll forward you a copy. And if you'd like my book, you can find it on Amazon. It is in Kindle version and physical copy. And podcast on the bigmikefund.com. Hope you're enjoying it. Why we even care about this risk-adjusted return? Why does it matter? Why even ask the question? Well, because in today's day and age, and it's just not today, it was in the past, it's going to be in the future. The project sponsors in commercial real estate or any kind of offerings, just operating businesses, I have seen them put absolutely nothing in the prospectus. So we're talking about project sponsors, we're talking about promoters, we're talking about fund managers, principals, and so on, in syndications, individual deals, sometimes real estate brokers too. They provide you with a property or a syndication, and they tell you all the nice things about it, and they will disclose the risks to the gazoo if they have a good attorney. But they don't have a word in the offering documents about risk-adjusted return. They just don't do it. If they really disclose risk-adjusted return, you would not invest in a lot of these projects. That's why it matters. So you have to be extremely smart about reading these documents and reading between the lines. So offering memorandums, private placement memorandums, disclose all kinds of risk, but they don't tell you how to adjust your expectations for these risks and how to compute wonderful risk-adjusted return. It's a real return that you should expect from the project, computing for the risk involved. And it's really up to you to decide how much reserves to set aside. If they're promoting you 20% return and your loss reserves on that project should be 15%, your real return is only 5%. That's the whole problem, is that they'll never tell you how to compute it. It comes up to you. They just paint the pretty picture. So the other very important point I wanted to stress is that a given project must fit into your overall portfolio. Whatever the portfolio plan, whatever financial advisor you're working with, whatever is your portfolio goals, make sure that a given project fits in it. If you're looking for safe investment grade type of projects and you got a speculative ground up construction, it just doesn't fit in your portfolio. It's a non-starter. You shouldn't even bother looking into a project like that. Don't invest because of the offering memorandum or private placement memorandum promises great returns. That is an extreme danger territory. These documents that you are given are marketing documents. They're legal documents to protect the sponsor, not necessarily fair documents to help you assess the risk and the return and a risk-adjusted return on these projects. So let's chat a little bit about this very basic topic. I mentioned this many times. I love this discussion point, and that's why we are talking about it again. So Benjamin Graham was sort of the godfather of value investing. Warren Buffett learned from Benjamin Graham, said that an investment operation is one which, through thorough analysis, promises safety of the principal and a satisfactory return. Everything else is speculative. In today's day and age, especially in 2019, the market is just full of speculative investments. A lot of ground-up constructions, development, redevelopments. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm not saying they're bad, but they're speculative in nature. Please, please, please know the difference. So now we're going to talk about these investment quadrants. This methodology is something that I'm very passionate about. I've put this concept forward. I don't claim to reinvent the wheel. I'm just delivering this information in a manner that is easy to understand and hopefully helpful to your overall education and ability to make decisions through the investment quadrants prism. Think of it this way. You're wearing these wonderful glasses just like I am, and the glasses can tell you, is something an investment grade or something is speculative? Would that help? That would be wonderful, right? Unfortunately, these glasses are not for sale. If I had them, I wouldn't sell them for any price. No, I'm kidding. I'd make copies and I would be selling them for a good price to help you make these decisions. There is no easy answer. Investment-grade projects are those that have good downside protection. That is the key concept that I wanted to convey. It's not always easy or straightforward to look at a project and decide, is this an investment-grade or is this speculative? And some projects are borderline. So you just have to have the education and the basic concepts to be able to make these decisions or at least understand on a high level where this project belongs to. So quadrant number one is investment-grade projects focused on cash flow. Really important, they'll have good downside protection through mechanisms. We'll talk about a few mechanisms, such as being a first lien loan or even an equity investment with moderate leverage so that the debt is a good bank debt. That leverage works for you. It helps you enhance the return, but doesn't put too much stress on a cash flow. These projects typically have pretty high debt service coverage ratio. So there's all kinds of reserves, extra cash, that enables them to be in the investment grade category. They generally have good initial cash flow. And in my experience, this is not an exact number. It's a range and it varies by market conditions. And these type of projects deliver solid low double-digit return. And they generally will have a degree of safety associated with them. Let me continue. Quadrant two is investment grade projects focused on growth. They have also good downside protection. They have also low to moderate risk, but they have limited cash flow, acquisitions of first lien loans that are defaulted, but with a low LTV, a typical example in this quadrant. Significant value add projects could be in this quadrant. The cash flow is low, but the growth is high. As they go through the value add life cycle, they increase upside in these projects, and they create future cash flow, which will compensate for the lack of cash flow in the initial year or two, but they will cash flow much stronger in the future years. It's very important. The speculative grade projects, typically quadrant three, could be focused on cash flow like second lien loans. They have limited downside protection because they're in second position. Or they could be highly leveraged syndications where the leverage return on equity is high, but the leverage is so high that when the market is stressing the project, the cash flow will go away very quickly, and then they will be running low liquidity and it can fall apart. So this, they're speculative grade. Also, quadrant four, if we look at that, that is a lot of ground-up projects, development, redevelopment, land speculation. And these type of projects have very high degree of risk. And they should be looked at very, very carefully. They may promise high degree of return, but the level of risk in these projects is very high. And they have very limited downside protection. Please remember, all projects have risk. If somebody says this is risk-free, this is guaranteed, call Bernie Madoff. Seriously, projects have risks. Even government bonds secured by the U.S. government have risks. What is the risk? Well, if the interest rates move up, the principal on these bonds could be worth less than it was worth when the rates were lower. So they're subject to the interest rate fluctuations. There's always risk. So here are some examples of a risk: construction risk, local government or local zoning board risk, occupancy risk, insufficient capital risk, environmental risk, local market conditions risk, shortage of capital, lack of liquidity, financial projections risk, actual performance risk, Keyman risk, natural disaster risk, and so on and so forth. Just remember that investment-grade projects generally have better risk mitigation strategy, lighter level of risk, while the speculative projects present higher level of risk. Please remember that none of these investments are guaranteed investment-grade nor speculative. It's just the risk-adjusted return is the math that kind of separates the winners and the losers. So how do you compute this risk-adjusted return? This fancy term. And the way you compute it, the formula is extremely simple. So risk-adjusted return equals to the projected return, whatever that return that is on marketing documents, OM, PPM, it's just the projected return. There's a number. Sometimes it's a range. There's always a better way to do it is through a range. But let's just say it's a number. And then what you need to subtract from the projected return is the loss reserves. Loss reserves is a mathematical number that adjusts for the risks on a given project. That is the key way to understand risk-adjusted return. So now we're going to look at the capital stack and the risk versus reward as part of the capital stack. This is the most fundamental and the most basic thing that exists in any type of investing. This is true for stock market. This is true for bond market. This is true for alternative investments. This is true for real estate. This is true for non-real estate investments in the alternative investment space. It could be on a company level or on a project level. It could be on a fund level or individual deal level. So projects have typically senior debt. If that exists, some projects have, they have no debt. It's all equity. But you need to understand, if they do have debt and there's a senior debt, it is the most safe component of the investment that typically have carry low risk, and typically they're senior on a capital stack. So potential return is lower because the risk is lower. These type of projects, their risk-adjusted return is solid because they're taking very low risk. I'm not saying you should only be investing in senior debt, but certainly when you're investing in senior debt, you have pretty good downside protection, assuming you invested in a good project at a good LTV. After the senior debt, there could be junior debt or preferred equity. So junior debt would be generally more senior than the preferred equity. Some cases don't have junior debt, they just have preferred equity. But they're second behind the senior debt. So it's either preferred equity or junior debt or combination of the two. They generally have medium level of risk, and they need to have sort of a moderate level or medium level of return to compensate for higher level of risk than the senior debt. And then the joint venture equity, common equity, has highest degree of risk. And there, the projected return, the potential return on these projects has to be higher. You will need to adjust for risk. But if you are investing in common equity and your potential return is low and the degree of risk is high, well, your risk-adjusted return could be negative. That's the whole point. You have to understand what you're investing into, where it is on a capital stack, and what is the level of risk that investment carries. So how do you compute loss reserves? Well, the loss reserves are, it's a complex problem. It's not a single problem that you can get an answer through a exact mathematical formula. It doesn't always exist. You need to have experience and ability to ascertain variables, to analyze a project and come up with the right methodology, how to look at this. So number one, start by looking at the capital stack. That is the basics. What are you investing into? Are you investing into senior debt, or are you investing in the junior debt? Are you investing in the preferred equity? Are you investing in common equity? So when you understand that, where you are in the capital stack, that's the foundation, that's the basics. Next, look at the value of the equity behind you. So if you invested in senior debt, there might be junior debt, there might be equity behind you. Look at the combination of what's behind you. How safe is your investment? What is your loan-to-value ratio or equity-to-value ratio? So if you're an equity investment and then you take the senior debt ahead of you and then you add your equity and you are at 80% combined, sort of the debt plus your equity, you still have 20% behind you. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but you need to know what it is. You could be at 100% of the equity, but the investment could still be very strong. You have a lot of upside. There's a value add. There's a competent operator. So that ratio by itself is not the only decision driver, but it gives you a pretty good foundation, especially if you're investing in a debt of a project. Is it senior debt, secondary debt? Is there equity behind you? These type of questions you need to understand. Next, you should look at the sponsor and the operator, the experience, integrity, and track record. Well, why does it matter? Well, you're entrusting somebody with your money. They're going to run the project forward. And if they know what they're doing, they have a ton of experience, they're high integrity, and they have good track record, these are good starting points. If you invest with an idiot, you'll find a way to destroy value. So just think about it. Next, look at the market conditions and the economic cycle conditions. Why? Well, if you invested at the bottom of the market, when everything was cheap and everything was trading, well, a lot of things were trading below the reconstruction cost, below book value, if there were stocks and bonds, you couldn't go wrong because everything was at a big discount. You just couldn't go wrong. Now we're at the peak of the market. Economic cycle is now slowing down. Yield curve just inverted. So it is possible we're going to see a slowdown. It is likely we're going to see a slowdown. And you have to understand the trend. Trend is your friend. And you should look at the future projections to whatever degree you believe in the future projections. And if you don't believe in the projections, go on Amazon.com, find a great crystal ball. Maybe it'll help. My crystal ball broke a long time ago, fortunately. And I can't project the future very well. We try to prepare for the good, the bad, and the ugly. Hopefully, our preparation will help us deal with all of the above conditions. But the point is the same. You need to be looking at the trend and where the market is going. How do you compute loss reserves? One of the very basic methodologies that I like to use, and it is commonly used, is essentially applying stress tests to key inputs in calculations of these commercial projects. So these projects have certain methodologies on computation of pro forma occupancy, pro forma income, pro forma expenses. So do some manipulations with the data. Reduce the occupancy by 10%. It's a significant stress test. So if they were projecting 95% occupancy, what happens with 85% occupancy? What does the cash flow look like when the project is stressed? Same thing on the expenses. Increase expenses. Maybe the taxes will go up. Maybe there will be problems with the, you'll need additional capex expenses. There might be catastrophic problems. Increase expenses. What if they do take place? That creates a buffer. You see, look at the cash flow, what happens with higher vacancy and high expenses. And when you're computing the back-end sale price, one of the fundamental problems that I see with today's sponsors, many of these sponsors, they use low cap rates that they used to for the last X number of years. And these cap rates may not hold number of years from now. 5 years from now, the cap rates may be higher. When they're higher, the prices for the same assets are going to be lower. They go in the inverse direction. And the consequence of this is that they're not going to get the price they're looking for in the future, and the value created, in essence, will be lower, and the return will be lower. So the loss reserve has to be higher, adjusting for that cap rate expansion risk. So adjust the return, adjust the project return, the risk-adjusted return, by the stress test condition reduction in the projected total return. Now, you may be overstressing the project, and it may be unrealistic that the numbers will be that low, but when the sponsor promises you 20% return on a given project, and you stress test it, and it looks like it's going to be 10 to 12, well, that's your risk-adjusted return. You just adjusted it down by 8 to 10%. Is this still good enough for you? You have to make that decision. But the point is the same. The stress test will help you understand very much what the scenario is going to look like. Maybe that's your floor. Maybe the 10 to 12% return on that project completely acceptable to you, and it's a bad case scenario. So have a base case and have a bad case. So generally speaking, what I like to do is when the proposed return is 20%, the base case may be 16 and a bad case may be 12. So at that point, you have a decent understanding what could happen. Is the 10 to 12% return catastrophic? Absolutely not. It's probably a decent return. But if you're not adjusting for it, you'll be expecting 20% and you'll likely be disappointed. Very rarely or ever do I see sponsors hit these targets in a down market. In a good market, yeah, they can exceed these projected targets. But in a bad market, when everything is going in the wrong direction, these projections never hold. So note, it is very hard to assign the right number to each investment. There are many variables, some tangibles and some intangibles. And market conditions can make a drastic difference on loss reserves needed for each type of project. Just be aware of this. So here's loss reserve guidance in normal market. These numbers are not guaranteed. These numbers are my personal opinion. They could be different with different folks. They could be different in different projects. It's a matter of opinion. All it is, it's just my understanding of what these numbers should look like in normal markets, but they may be different on different projects. So I'm giving you some level of ranges so you have an idea what to assign when you're looking at these type of projects and what you're investing into. So if you're investing in senior debt with good equity behind you, say loan-to-value ratio is below 70%, your loss reserves are low, say 0.25% to 1%. It's unlikely that you're going to get hit really hard in these type of projects. So if you're projecting to make, say, 9% return, 9 to 10% return, you can adjust it down by, say, 1%. You can adjust it by 0.5%. There's no magic number. It's a range. It's probably 1% or less on these conservative projects. If you're looking at the senior debt, but moderate leverage, now you're at 80%. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with 80%. Government makes Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, makes a lot of first lien mortgages at 80% LTV. And off top of my head, I don't know what number they're tracking as a loss reserve. But in my understanding, 80% is a bit high. So their loss reserve should be 1% to 3%. This is my understanding. It varies by market conditions. In good market, that number is low. In bad market, that number is higher. So there's no magic to this. It's really something that you need to think about. But if you're doing your hard money loan, 80% LTV, but with a very experienced sponsor on a very good project, it's probably, you could be on 1% loss reserve. But if the sponsor is an idiot and you're taking a lot of risk, you probably should be above 3%. I'm just giving you some kind of approximate range. It really varies. So it's just higher. All we're comparing here, 70% to 80% LTV. The 10% difference jumps loss reserves quite a bit. Now, if you're investing in junior debt, second lien loans, preferred equity, your loss reserves should be most certainly higher. How high do they go? Well, it depends. There's so many variables, it becomes really hard. You're no longer senior on the capital stack. It could be as low as 1% or it could be higher than 10%. It could be somewhere in between. There's so many variables. What I would focus on is cash flow and liquidity of these projects. If you're in junior debt or in a preferred equity, is there a good cash flow story? Is there enough cash flow to service first debt? At that point, you're in good position because you're behind the first debt and your position is protected because first debt is well serviced. That's the important way to look at this. Now, if you're on a common equity position, it could be on a real estate project or it could be common equity of a corporation. In good markets, as you can see, common equity trades at great values and it appreciates and does well. But most people don't realize when they invest in stock that they need a risk-adjusted return consideration. They need loss reserves. When they're buying these speculative stuff, stocks, things can go down. Same thing on real estate projects or any projects. The loss reserves probably, in my view, between 2 and 20%, but they could be higher. Execution of the business plan, value add plan, market condition, experience of the sponsor or the operator, and many other factors matter. Now, let's talk a little bit about loss reserves for investment grade projects versus speculative projects. We talked about investment grade. The key concept is that the investment grade great projects must have strong downside protection mechanisms. It's a first lien loan. It's slightly leveraged equity with good cash flow. The loss reserves for these projects are not that high because they're not likely to fail miserably and lose principal to a high extent. It's possible, but it's just not likely. So the basic definition of any risk is a combination of likelihood and impact. If likelihood is low, the chances are the risk overall is low. That's all I'm saying. The impact could be still strong, but that combination between the likelihood and the impact creates the actual risk, that mathematical formula. So loss reserves on investment-grade projects are generally not high. I would put it between 1% and 3%, probably average 1% to 2%. And again, these projects need to be able to withstand stress test conditions. Whatever you feel is appropriate, by stressing them, you get a concept of what happens when these things don't go well. Speculative grade projects. Speculative grade projects carry tremendous amount of risk, and the loss reserves on them have to be very high, much, much higher than the investment grade. Some of these projects are ground-up construction projects, development, redevelopment, land speculation, highly leveraged projects, second lien debt, and so forth. These project loss reserves could be 5 to 20%, probably average 6 to 7%, but that average varies with market conditions. In good market, it's probably lower. In bad market, it's higher. That's the fundamental concept, and I am not sure how exactly to quantify it because it's hard to quantify it. These are the basic concepts that will give you ability to make your own decisions. But you can't rely on, nobody's going to write you exact formula how to do this in the right market because it doesn't exist. And the projects vary, sponsors vary, market conditions vary, but you need to be preparing to with a higher range, whatever number you feel comfortable. So market conditions and project-specific risks make humongous difference. They can make all the difference in the world. Now let's talk about risk-adjusted ROI and volatility of ROI in conjunction to the quadrants that we talked about. So investment-grade, cash flow-focused quadrant one, again, has good downside protection, low and moderate risk. The average IRR, 10 to 15%. The risk-adjusted return, I'm using an example of 1%. It's low. Why? Because the risk is low. So a risk-adjusted ROI is simply 9 to 14%, following the formula shown earlier. You take 10%, you subtract 1%, you wind up with 9. You take 15%, you subtract 1, you wind up with 14. So risk-adjusted return here is pretty healthy. And the volatility is low because your loss reserves are low. It's not going to have a lot of variance. This type of projects are not likely going to have big swings. They're just much more steady eddy type of projects. That's why that should be most likely core of your portfolio. Now let's talk about quadrant two, investment grade projects focused on growth. Their target IRR should be higher. Otherwise, why invest in the projects with no cash flow? Because they got to have some level of higher return. And the loss reserves, I'm using 2% in this example. Now, it doesn't have to be 2%. It could be 3%. It could be 1.5%. There's no magic number. But certainly, it's a little bit higher risk than the quadrant one. And the volatility in these projects is also generally low. Why? Because the risks, the loss reserves are not high, and these projects perform more or less predictably, more predictably than speculative projects. Now let's look at the speculative grade, quadrant three. Quadrant three, projected IRR is higher, but the loss reserves jump up quite a bit higher too. In this case, I'm using 6%. Maybe it needs to be even higher. It's hard for me to say. It depends on the market conditions. I'm just using 6% as an example. But the difference between investment grade and speculative loss reserves is very, very significant. So you want a 2% investment grade, probably 6, 7% on average, maybe higher in the speculative grade. And the volatility is high because these projects will perform, some will perform very well, and some will collapse miserably. That's why you have to be prepared that some of these projects will go catastrophically bad and you'll lose all your money. So high risk reserve will compensate for those bad conditions. The speculative grade growth projects, quadrant four projects, have also pretty high loss reserves. I'm not differentiating between quadrant three and four. I'm keeping the loss reserves at 6% because I don't know. There's a lot of risk in both. Hard to say. It might need to be a little higher, but the point is still the same. Your risk-adjusted return needs to come down quite a bit as a result of high loss reserves. So here's an example of investment-grade quadrants. I'm giving approximate range of what the cash flow will look like, investment grade, and then speculative and cash flow focus versus growth focus. So quadrant one, typically the cash flow is in the 7 to 12% range, and examples of these projects would be like one of our flagship fund, Tampa Opportunity Fund, and a number of other funds, and again, similar funds in their structure and focus. And then the quality cash flow syndications in multifamily self-storage and so on. I'll show you some of these examples later. The investment-grade growth-focused projects generally have no cash flow, light cash flow. So it's a 0 to 6% range. Typically, investments in non-performing nodes, so syndications with good loan-to-value ratio, have value-add projects like multifamily, some self-storage, that at least have the break-even cash flow. The break-even cash flow is a differentiator between investment-grade and speculative. Quadrant number three, speculative-grade, cash flow-focused, they could generate strong cash flow. Here, the cash flow could be 12% to 24% as a second lien loan interest. It could be generally cash monsters. But when they go bad, you can lose all your capital. Having leveraged syndications fall in the same bucket. You could have a lot of potential appreciation upside and strong cash flow because of the return on equities is great with high leverage, but the high leverage could destroy the project when the financials turn and they run out of cash. Speculative grade, quadrant four, growth focused, same type of risk. The cash flow non-existent or very low. And there's all kinds of risk, but the appreciation has to be, the projected appreciation has to be strong. Otherwise, why invest? These projects in quadrant four could be phenomenal investments in a good market. So a lot of condo developments have been popping up while the market has been good. And they continue to build condos, but the markets are softening up. And a lot of these newly built buildings could oversupply the market. Inventories could be high, and they wouldn't sell. What happens then? Developers are going to get stuck. They're not going to be able to sell these units. They're going to try to lease them, rent them, but these expensive property, the rent roll may be insufficient to service the debt. Their only exit strategy, most of these projects, is to sell. If they can't sell for the price they want, the projects could fail miserably. So that's the key understanding of these speculative projects. So what is a quality cash flow syndication? Or a similar fund focused on cash flow? Could be multifamily, self-storage, retail, office space, and so forth. Generally speaking, there is some value add. And the value add in these quality cash flow syndications is generally light or moderate. Heavy syndications could fall in the quadrant two or could even fall into speculative grade projects if they have negative cash flow. So value add, light value add, or moderate value add, some expansion, some opportunistic of sales of old parcels or other parts of the portfolio could generate the value add component of the strategy. So this is generally, I like value add, but quality cash flow projects can't have heavy, heavy value add because they would not be investment grade at that point. Improved asset management, you see that, lease up additional services, better collections, tenant mix improvements, so forth. A few interesting key things to pay attention to. Look at the cash flow. It's probably the number one thing you should look at. The cash flow tells a story. As they're improving units, take a multifamily, they're renovating. The first year cash flow could be light. Why? Because they're renovating units, the occupancy low at that point, and the distributions are light. And that's fine. 6% here is an example. It could be lower. It doesn't have to be 6%. I do like when it is at least 6%, but it's not the only kind of a driver of quality cash flow syndication. So don't just look at the cash flow of year one as the only variable. Look at the cash flow story. If year one is subdued, but year two is improving and year three is improving, and you see it over multiple years improving cash flow, that gives you, it's a good story. And with leverage, light leverage, again, here's an example of a leverage which I consider moderate leverage, 60 to 70% loan to value. In other words, there's a 30 to 40% of equity in a project, of actual capital deployed. So the debt service coverage ratio should be well above the norm. So projects with 75% leverage and higher, sometimes they use this debt service coverage ratio 1.2, 1.25. That's not a great debt service coverage ratio. It's the minimum debt service coverage ratio for the banks to be able to make a loan. You want to see a project with debt service coverage ratio 1.5, 1.6, 1.7, even higher, 2. If you can get there, that's great. These type of projects have ton of cash, and they can survive stress tests, and they can manage through difficult times too. So a fair preferred return and a fair split. I like to see prefs in the 8-12% range and split 60-40-70-30-80-20 in favor of investors, not the sponsor, obviously. And there might be some IRR hurdles. If investors get, say, 12%, then the ratio may switch a little bit. So IRR hurdle could be anywhere between 12-18%. But that's a good problem to have. If investors got, say, 16% IRR hurdle and they received it, and there's more return above that, the sponsor can get a little bit bigger share of the return above that. There's nothing fundamentally wrong. I've seen deals with, for example, 8% pref, 75-25 until 16% IRR, and then it goes 50-50. Is there anything wrong with that? No, absolutely not. It's a fine split. The other key component of these quality of cash flow syndications is high quality sponsors. They got to have high integrity, strong track record, good communications, and so on. So how do market conditions impact various type of projects? Well, the projects with cash flow focus with light and no leverage have generally low risk and they need low reserves. And the cash is the king. You really don't care if the value drops as much as you care about the cash flow. If cash flow is strong, you can survive value of the drop. You don't even care about it. So who cares if on paper this asset is worth a little bit less than yesterday? If you're getting the cash, you're in good shape. So good downside protection is the key characteristic here. Low LTV can make a big difference. Growth projects with leverage generally have high risk and require high reserves. Having good liquidity and good cash reserves on these projects as part of the underwriting is paramount. Why? Well, because there could be delays with construction, cost overruns, slow lease up, and having cash to manage through these difficult times will make a big difference. And investors who participate in speculative projects with leverage should be prepared for some capital calls in the future, or there will be serious dilution. Somebody might come in at the late stage, the project is out of cash, and the bank is starting the foreclosure, and they'll offer equity at terrible terms to existing investors, and there will be a difficult situation. So when you invest in these projects, you have to be prepared to be dealing with these type of conditions, especially if the market turns around. A couple of words about should you invest in individual deals or funds. Just for comparison's sake, we've talked about this in the past, but I'm just going to quickly cover the difference. When you invest in a single deal could be a property, it could be one syndication. Typically have higher risk concentration, higher volatility. Fund is generally diversified. You may have low liquidity. You put the money in the deal until there's a liquidity event, like refinancing or sale. You may not be able to sell your units. Some deals might allow it for it, and most don't. Funds generally have better liquidity. They might have redemption subscription type of process where you can actually exit your investment sooner than the life cycle of a project. Not all funds are like this. This is something that you need to be aware of. Typically, open-ended funds allow it. Closed-ended funds may have limited liquidity because they acquire assets for a certain amount of time, then they run assets through the life cycle, and then they exit assets. So they may have no liquidity while these assets are going through the life cycle of these projects. If you're doing an individual investment and you're signing on a mortgage, you have potential liability risk. When you invest in a fund, you have no liability or limited liability. Direct investments have more active involvements. The funds are generally completely passive. What happens is if you invest into a lot of these deals that come back and money comes back and you have idle funds on sidelines, money may not be working well. And you put the money in the fund, the money is working all the time, at least earning the pref per the offering documents of the fund. Please remember that IRA investors have a risk of UBIT, unrelated business income tax, associated with debt leverage of a deal, whether it's an individual deal or syndication. Funds may have same problems, same risk if they have leverage on a fund level. but there is no bid, you bid, generally speaking, if there's no debt leverage on a fund level. When you invest in an individual deal, when you're trying to acquire property, you need the right amount of capital. When you invest in a fund, you're a lot more flexible. You could put some money today. You could put some more money in the future. You could take some money out when the redemptions are allowed. So it's a lot more flexible, and you can reinvest distributions. That is it. I hope this was educational. I hope you enjoyed the presentation. And it's an important topic. People have asked me for it. How do I compute risk-adjusted return? Well, this is a little bit of a methodology, a little bit of an approach to use when you're trying to think about the problem and you're trying to come up with a good, consistent solution. Anyway, I appreciate you listening. You could find me again at bigmikefund.com and enjoy the rest of your day. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to bigmikefund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.